This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So is 2015 the year we all get a raise? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Friday, December 26th. There's one thing on a whole lot of people's wish lists that hasn't been delivered yet, and that's a raise, a hefty, solid bump in pay. But if not this year, maybe next? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore starts us off.
For the past 5 years, it has not been a very Merry Christmas as far as wages have been concerned.
Real wages have been pretty much flat.
That's Elise Gould with the Economic Policy Institute.
When you adjust for inflation, they have pretty much gone nowhere.
In response, Americans have been pretty pessimistic about this. The University of Michigan asks consumers every month how much they think their pay will rise in the next year or two. 10 years ago, people were saying 3% or so. After the recession, that went down to almost zero.
Americans really lost the sense of optimism.
Peter Fisher is a senior fellow at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. He says things started to change recently.
Now, just in the last several months, we've seen a big pickup in the survey data.
People are now saying they think they'll get a 1.7% raise, which is just a teensy bit above inflation, which is around 1.3%.
That indicates the American consumer is seeing an improvement in the labor market.
So we think we're going to get a raise. Will we?
There is some chance.
Justin Wilfers is senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says wages start to rise when the line of people out there willing to take your job starts to shorten.
If the unemployment rate keeps decreasing, then we're going to be in a position where workers have the bargaining power to ask for somewhat higher real wages.
20 states and the District of Columbia just increased the minimum wage, which will force up wages at the bottom end of the income spectrum. And average hourly wages jumped a fraction in December. But in general, for everyone else, it's a wait-and-see game. In Washington, D.C., I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
To help us predict the outcome of that wait-and-see game and to peer into other corners of the economic future for 2015, Cardiff Garcia with the blog FT Alphaville and Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal are with us now. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Adrian.
So we're going to get to wages in a second, but let's start about the slew of good economic numbers this week. We have GDP at 5%. The Dow crossed 18,000. Consumer sentiment is up. I talked to Treasury Secretary Jack Lew earlier this week, and I want to play for you guys one thing he said.
What we've seen over the past several quarters is that the economy is growing at a healthy rate. Growing at the fastest pace in over a decade is significant. And we're now seeing the strongest year for job growth since the 1990s.
So, Cardiff, economic recovery achieved? Are we in hunky-dory territory now?
Look, I don't want to become too optimistic here because the recovery since the end of the recession has been so sluggish. But this year has been a good one, and those numbers from the third quarter really were awfully good. I think that's also been reflected in a lot of the jobs reports. And most of the jobs reports this year, we've had 10 straight months, I believe, of 200,000-plus jobs created. So this is good news. There's still a lot of ground to cover. I mean, everything's not great for everyone. I thought that segment on real wages was really important because that's been something that we haven't seen just yet, but there are some nascent signs that that's starting to pick up as well. So I just want to say that there's nothing so good that it can't be undone by bad policy or a bit of bad luck. And there's been plenty of that in the last few years. But right now, the trend is solid and I'm feeling better than I have in quite some time.
And Sudeep, what about you? How are you feeling?
I think we are on a pretty good trajectory, but there are so many risks out there. You have to be a little bit wary of too much good news. We are obviously ending 2014 much better than we started. We actually had a contraction in the beginning of the year, and that actually shows how choppy we've been throughout the year and throughout the recovery. We've had a lot of big ups and some big downs along the way, and that just shows that there's a lot of room for error in the path we're on.
Cardiff, how concerned are you about volatility, the volatility we've seen and going forward?
Yeah, that's a big question. I mean, Sudeep just mentioned how we started the year, and it tells you something about the fragility of the recovery to this point, that something like bad weather knocked us off the trajectory right. for a whole quarter earlier this year. And so that's definitely something to worry about. That said, I do think that the improvement has accelerated in the past 9 or 10 months or so. I'm somewhat cautiously optimistic that it'll continue, but there's a lot of variables that you need to consider here. You know, for instance, despite the progress in the labor market, we still know that a lot of people in the prime age categories, that's people ages 25 to 54, a much lower share of those people are either in a job or looking for work than before. I think until that number, for instance, starts to pick back up, I wouldn't say, you know, mission accomplished just yet. But again, I really am feeling better about the trajectory here. And I think it's okay during the holiday season to celebrate
that. To smile a little bit.
Exactly.
I want to get to wages now, like we just heard. Do you guys think this is the year where we're all going to get paid a little bit more, Cardiff?
I do. I think this is something that's been kind of mysterious to a lot of economists in the last few years, the extent to which there's what they call labor market slack. It was referenced in that segment. How many people are looking for a job relative to how many jobs are out there? Well, the more jobs that are created, the more bargaining power workers have. I think we're going to see some improvement in the next year.
And what about you, Sudeep?
If we continue on this track of good news, then we should be pretty close to a 5% unemployment rate by a year from now. And if we are there, then we must have seen wage increases along the way. It's inconceivable that we can go in a normal course of a recovery and see a 5% unemployment rate without at least some pickup in wages. If we aren't there, that shows that we actually have some much deeper problems in the economy that aren't being resolved.
And Sudeep, as you look ahead to 2015, what worries you the most?
Mine is actually a global worry. The United States is looking pretty good right now, but around the world, we've seen a huge gap between expectations for the economy and what reality has delivered. That's actually, you can see it in stock markets. It's pushed up stock markets. It's pushed down borrowing costs. And it's actually given too many people, both inside in government and out of government, a little too much room to move slowly with a sense of calm. And so eventually something's got to give. And my fear is what happens when those two forces is correct and people realize that there's a huge gap there.
Cardiff Garcia with the blog FT Alphaville and Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Have a
happy
good
holidays. Markets today, we have a couple more records. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For the second day today, the digital Grinch has stolen Christmas for gamers. Networks went dark from Microsoft's Xbox and Sony PlayStation users. A group of hackers that calls themselves Lizard Squad is taking responsibility for the problems. Hacks like this can cost companies big. They've got to fix the problem. They might lose some sales. There's the longer-term damage to the brand. But it turns out there's also a way to protect against those losses, a growing market for insurance against cyber attacks. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
It's unclear if Sony or Microsoft had hacker insurance. We did try to reach them. We do know breaches of web-based game systems come at great economic damage. Richard Betterly, a risk consultant to insurance companies and their clients, says there are policies to cover some costs.
The cost of notifying the affected persons, the customers, that there was a breach, the cost of providing credit monitoring, sometimes crisis management, public relations campaigns, in other words.
Like regular insurance, if something goes wrong, you, the company, file a claim and hope for a check. Lots of stuff isn't covered, like stolen ideas and customer credit card losses. But with Xbox and PlayStation joining a hacked wall of shame alongside Home Depot and JP Morgan and Target, more and more companies are buying some peace of mind, says Larry Poneman, a cybersecurity researcher.
lots of organizations were just dabbling in this area of insurance a couple of years ago. But with all of these data breaches, more and more insurance companies see huge amounts of profits to be made.
Insurers face their own danger, though. They can't predict hacking losses the way they can for tornadoes or fires. Here's Ted Julian of data protection firm CO3 Systems.
They're very much aware of their lack of actuarial data to underline how these policies are underwritten. They could lose quite a bit of money quickly if they're not careful.
This gets to the unpredictability of the bad guys. Each hack seems bigger and more creative than the last. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Among the many holiday movies out in theaters this week is an adaptation of a Broadway musical. Into the Woods is a story with some very adult themes like infidelity, sexual awakening, death. And now it's a Disney film. Fans were worried about how a brand like Disney, known for princesses and fairy tale endings, would pull it off. Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
Seeing Into the Woods was a formative experience for Michael Shulman, a theater critic for The New Yorker. After watching the Disney film adaptation, he breathed a sigh of relief because he felt the film was, for the most part, true to the spirit of the original.
One quibble I have is the casting of Little Red Riding Hood.
In the Disney version, Little Red Riding Hood is younger, and Shulman says some of the dark sexual chemistry between the wolf and Little Red Riding Hood is lost. Worries about this type of watering down of the adult themes erupted months ago when, in an interview, Stephen Sondheim said that this song, Any Moment, was likely going to be cut from the film.
Anything can happen in the woods. May I kiss you?
This scene is about infidelity. Cinderella's prince hooks up with the baker's wife.
Wait one moment, please. We can't do this.
Of course, you're right. How foolish. Foolishness can happen in the woods.
But it turns out this song did make it into the movie.
I think all the studios are starting to take bigger risks as they see the success of films.
Film producer and consultant Catherine Arnold says the success of films like The Hunger Games has pushed studios to develop young adult movies with more adult themes.
So I think Disney took this project Into the Woods and decided to go for it because they want to broaden their audience. They don't want to just be pigeonholed in children's animated world.
Arnold says it was a good risk. According to early estimates, the film brought in over $13 million on its release yesterday. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Over the next couple of weeks, we're checking in with some of our Marketplace beat reporters and what they're watching for next year. Today, we're talking healthcare. 2014 was a year of mergers and acquisitions, when big hospitals bought smaller ones and pharmaceutical companies bought other pharmaceutical companies. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein is with us to tell us whether bigger is actually better. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Adrian.
So if you're a patient, if you use healthcare, what's going to change in terms of healthcare in 2015?
Well, look, all these consolidations could mean a few things. On the one hand, we've all probably been in that super annoying situation where doctors ask us to fill out the same forms again and again.
Yes.
Well, mergers could make that go away because it should be easier. It should be easier for one big organization to share patient records. It could also mean not getting the same test twice. So there's potential for better convenience and spending less. I was talking about this potential with Tom Main, who's a partner with Oliver Wyman, earlier this week.
I think we're sitting at this incredible opportunity to be more connected, way more accessible, way more personalized, way more real time.
Certainly in some corners, Adrian, of the industry, people are really psyched that consolidation will help the healthcare system get rid of some of this waste and move the ball forward.
I'm sensing a but here, though, Dan. What's the but?
The but is that when you have a big organization and you are just one patient, it's really, really easy to get lost. And so something that I've learned on this beat, Adrian, is that relationships really matter. Hmm. And the patient-doctor relationship is so important. That patient and doctor need to be able to communicate. And if you just become a number in some big, huge, multi-hospital health system, it's really easy to get lost.
So how much does the Affordable Care Act influence what's happening right now?
I think a fair bit here. Look, you know, more and more hospitals and doctors are getting paid differently. They're penalized for things like readmission, their requirements to have electronic health records. That stuff is expensive. Doing this stuff is new and it's different. And people are just a little lost, understandably. And so that leaves people feeling anxious a bit and nervous a bit. And some people really believe the best way to weather this new era in healthcare is to be bigger. Bigger is better. They'll have more money on hand and they'll be able to do whatever they need to do to move. Others, though, especially when it comes to the hospital mergers, believe the bigger they are, the more leverage that they're going to have when they're actually negotiating with health insurers.
So what can we expect in 2015?
That's exactly the question that I asked Carnegie Mellon economist Martin Gaynor. Gaynor says since 1994, there have been 1,200 hospital mergers. And in certain markets, there have been 20, 40, 50%
wow.
price increases afterwards, I know. And when that happens, consumers, especially people like you and me who get our health care at work, are the ones who are impacted.
Actually, those increases just get passed on to workers dollar for dollar. So it actually comes home to roost directly on the backs of American workers.
So what we can expect next year, Adrian, is that if there's been a merger in your area, you can expect higher prices. And what's maybe scarier, Gaynor points to numerous studies that show patients who are treated in hospitals with less competitive markets face a higher chance of death.
Way to end the year on a bit of a downer there, Dan.
Sorry, Adrian.
Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, who says money can't buy love or trust?
You can charge friends a dollar apiece not to divulge their most intimate secrets.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 23 points, a tenth percent, to close at 18,053. The Nasdaq bumped up 33.7% to end the day at 4806. The S&P 500 slid up 6 points, a third percent, to finish at 2088. For the week, the Dow was up 1.4%. The Nasdaq and the S&P 500 both advanced 0.9%. Internet stocks had a good day. Groupon ripped up 3.1%. LinkedIn looped up 1.5%. Online retail giant Amazon clicked up 2%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.25%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Instead of eating holiday dinner leftovers for the next few days, may I suggest a bowl of pepper pot soup? This hot and spicy beef stew made its debut on this day in 1777. And in 1845, Texas officially became the 28th state. And happy birthday to English actor Jude Law, turning 42. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. There are, we learned from the American Bar Association, about 120,000 people enrolled in law schools around the country. 120,000 aspiring lawyers. It sounds like a lot, but it turns out it's a decrease of almost 7% from last year, and it's the lowest number of law students enrolled since 1987. There was a time not that long ago when law was seen as a go-to career, a way to ensure financial stability. Marketplace's Sally Herships looks at why that's changing.
You don't need a law degree to figure out why enrollment in law school is dropping.
There are so many law school grads coming out and not enough jobs.
Melissa Haber works with ExecuSearch, a recruiting firm. She helps companies hire lawyers. And actually, she's a lawyer, too.
So what's happening is these people are coming out of law school with $100,000 or more in debt, and they're either not finding a job or they're finding a job that pays maybe $50,000, $60,000 a year.
I mean, the legal industry is changing in every possible way.
James Leipold is executive director for the National Association for Law Placement. He says, just like with a lot of other industries, technology is partly to blame here. Take a corporate merger. How many lawyers does it take to negotiate? Used to be up to 18, but
there's now automated software where two lawyers can go through a question tree of 200 or 300 questions, and then the computer spits out a very sophisticated legal document.
And individuals can now buy cheap contracts or wills from online services like LegalZoom. Leipold says large law firms are also outsourcing and hiring temps. But as recently as 2000,
almost every school was reporting employment outcomes with 90% or more of their graduates employed.
Jerry Organ teaches at the University of St. Thomas School of Law in Minnesota. He says then schools didn't have to report what kinds of jobs their alumni were getting, but now they do. If you look at the last few years, he says only about half of students are getting full-time, long-term jobs as lawyers. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Today is the day stores attempt to sell us all the stuff we didn't buy before the holidays. Some places have piles of ornaments and winter gloves to unload. In others, the clearance racks are already pretty sparse. It's all the result of calls made months ago about how much to stock, bets placed about how much we'd all buy. Welcome to today's installment of our series, Holidays, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by
Conrad Wilson of Oregon Public Broadcasting takes a look at how stores stock their shelves.
Just a few days before Christmas, Jennifer Zyers stood in the toy aisle at a Target store in Portland, Oregon. She was shopping for her baby daughter, who smiled from her car seat tucked inside the red shopping cart.
Her name is Snow, and I know they have Snow White stuff, so I was just trying to see if they had any little, like, something small at Snow White.
Just a few aisles away, the once fresh-looking Christmas section was already picked over, complete with clearance signs. So how did Target decide on these kinds of toys and holiday decorations? Not to mention how many of them the store should have.
It is, to a large extent, a science combined with an art.
Akshay Rao is a marketing professor at the University of Minnesota. He says every year retailers face this classic problem where they try to determine how much to order without fully knowing the demand.
You look at historical data, you look at trends, you look at stated preferences in the marketplace through some sort of market research, and you come up with an estimate of what's going to be hot.
Rao says for many retailers, that's just the first step.
The other side of the equation is attempting to influence that demand.
Rao says retailers use tools like social media to steer customers towards certain products. He says they use discounts or emphasize features, like a phone with a fancy new camera, to entice customers to buy. But he says at the end of the day, there's still plenty of guesswork.
And people who guess right are considered geniuses and are often lucky. And people who guess wrong are left holding a fair amount of inventory that then goes on sale the day after Christmas.
But there's a new challenge for stores, says David Raffau, a business professor at Portland State University. He says customers are waiting longer to make decisions about what to purchase. And that's making it harder to predict holiday sales.
The way it used to be is that people would get signals like Black Friday, what's hot, what's not, and then they try to get it on their shelves, more of it, or whatever, as fast as possible. What are the sizes? What are the colors? What are the toys that people are wanting?
But Raffo says it's better for retailers to have too much inventory than not enough.
The cost of not having the product is lost sales. And it's not just the sale of that product, but if a retailer doesn't have what you want, you may go to another store and do all your other shopping at that other store.
And besides, without that extra stuff, how else would retailers be able to offer those great after Christmas deals? I'm Conrad Wilson for Marketplace.
Yep, there is a lot of stuff to buy out there today, but there are also those things we've been told money can't buy. Our friends Sam Weiner and Daniel Kibblesmith, authors of How to Win at Everything, say we're all suckers for believing it. Everything, they say, everything is for sale.
Some people say money can't buy love, happiness, or a life free of regret, but they are dead wrong.
Even priceless things have a price. Here's how to buy the things that money supposedly can't buy.
How can you buy respect? Don't waste long hours volunteering in your community and keeping promises to friends. You can buy respect by showing up everywhere wearing a solid gold suit of armor.
What about friendship? Ensure your popularity by stocking your home with one of every video game console, one of every type of dog, and replacing all carpeting in your house with those giant floor pianos from the movie Big.
The dogs will go nuts for it!
You can even buy love.
For what is love but a series of electrical reactions in the brain?
Pay a bunch of neuroscientists to develop an electrified baton that you can use to thwack people into falling in love with you.
Then there's trust. Trust is often given freely, but that's missing a huge business opportunity. You can charge friends a dollar apiece not to divulge their most intimate secrets. Finally, there is one thing money truly cannot buy. World peace. Unless, of course, you have a lot of money.
With sufficient resources, you can finance a utopia of mandatory smiling classes, mood-repressing drinking water, and an army of jackbooted helpers to keep your populace from expressing even a hint of discontent.
It's economics 101.
So the next time someone tells you that there are things money can't buy, remember, a $1,000 pair of noise-canceling headphones will shut that nonsense out of your head forever.
Sam Weiner and Daniel Kibblesmith with their take on the things money can buy. There's more of their wisdom at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
One final note before we finish up today. Turns out a whole lot of folks out there are taking selfies when they fill up their gas tank. Think big smiles, cheap prices. Other folks are taking pictures of just the prices. $1.91, $1.77. A search of Instagram this morning showed 65,691 images tagged with gas prices. I'm not sure if that speaks more to our excitement about cheap gas or our fascination with sharing everything about our lives. All right, that'll do it for Marketplace this week. The Dow rose 23 points, a 10%, to close at 18,053. The Nasdaq bumped up 33.7% to end the day at 4806, and the S&P 500 slid up 6 points, a 3%, to finish at 2088. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yor and is produced by Sitara Nieves. I'm Adrienne Hill. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday. This is 8 p.m.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.